Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, July 29th, the middle of the summer. My name is Magnus Tiewold. I'm your Peter, host for Peter, today, and along with me is Peter.
Peter R.H. Galway.
Good morning, Peter. We have a lot of interesting stuff on the show for you tonight. We're going to start off, or this morning, I don't know, tonight, I guess because it's gloomy today. Unexpected rain out there in the world. We're going to start off in a few moments with a report from our friends at Smithers about some of the recent developments in treaties with First Nations. We reported a couple weeks ago about a couple nations who've initial treaties with the federal and provincial governments, and some of their neighbors are not so happy about that, so we'll hear about that in a moment. We have a couple other reports. We have Hannah Fraser is going to stop by to give us a lowdown in what's in the peak this week. We have Gardening with Embark with Pablo Vimas. And Peter here, what are you here to talk about today?
Well, I saw like an interesting YouTube posting. It was about why Western designs fail in the developing world. Mm-hmm. And it was things that they thought, there were projects that thought would work and they kind of fell through. And I'll sort of bring up a few other issues, too, connected to that.
Excellent. So no stunning developments in the world of American politics this weekend?
Well, J.D. Lance. Is that his name?
Vance. J.D. Vance.
He's just... the thing is that if Trump gets elected, he could be president because Trump could be just Joe Biden in 3 years. You know, or
very much so.
Die over or something.
Yep.
I mean, he's not good.
I mean, I guess the sort of stunning development in U.S. politics is that, last week, of course, 2 weeks ago, there was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump, candidate Donald Trump.
Yeah.
A week ago, Joe Biden dropped out of the race and endorsed Kamala Harris. Which, of course, is just an endorsement, but it seems at lightning speed over the past week or so, the party seems to have rallied behind her, and she does seem to be the heir apparent now, as the official process hasn't happened. But it also seems to have turned that campaign on its head. I mean, up until those things happened, it really seemed that the energy and the momentum was with the Republicans and the Donald Trump campaign, and that seems to have shifted very much to the Democrats and Kamala Harris. Granted, it's, we're months out from the election and lots can happen, but it's certainly a big turnaround.
Well, one thing happened, Kamala Harris, they had the Prime Minister of Israel come over, and I think she was not in the Congress or the Senate during and I think she's Joe Biden was losing a lot of, they say, younger people that said they didn't like how things were going in with the Israeli war, but she sort of came out more strongly with a position sort of against a lot of the Israeli actions have been. So I think that's going to help.
Definitely it can, yeah. Benjamin Netanyahu was in the United States last week and spoke to a joint session of Congress, which, well, this is just my personal view, but seems like an outrageous honor given, the war that Israel is engaged in right now in Gaza. You know, whatever your specific position, it does seem a very dubious sort of thing to bring him into that position and that platform. But also, it also did kind of show that, as you, you know, I think a lot of the support that Israel has traditionally been able to count on within the United States is perhaps, I don't know if I would say slipping away, but perhaps not as solid as it used to be. And more than half of Democratic members of Congress, of both the Senate and the House of Representatives, were not in attendance for his speech, which is, you know.
Including Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
And I think Joe Biden is sort of took the middle road. You wind up, both sides are not going to be liking you at the end.
Mm-hmm.
The people that want more supportive Israel, the people that want less. So Joe Biden was stuck in the middle, where Kamala Harris at least made a position. The other thing I think what's happening with this, worldwide opinion, is that now with the internet, there's a lot of, I mean, you can go to a variety of opinion. They got YouTube postings, podcasts, information. You can say, well, some of this information is invalid, but the thing is that there's a lot of flow now. And with the illegal settlements, I mean, now you're seeing that they have actually have paved roads. These happened after October 7th. They have paved roads going from illegal settlement to illegal settlement that the Palestinians can't go on. and that may not be on the CBS Evening News, but you can sort of access
mm-hmm.
this. And I think it's so we're now, it's not like, the key to the Six-Day Wars was 6 days, you know, too.
Right.
And the 1973 one, you didn't have a lot of the information on either side too. And the other thing was that during that era it was more of the Vietnam conflict.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were, now the entire focus is on this.
Yeah.
So
You know, one thing that's really different about this war as opposed to the other two you mentioned was that those were, you know, military conflicts between organized militaries, where is this one is ostensibly, you know, a conflict between, you know, the Israeli military and Hamas, but kind of the practical reality of, you know, Hamas it being kind of asynchronous warfare, where Hamas, they're at front lines and Hamas doesn't sort of have a, you know, an established position and they're not on uniforms, means, and that, and then also that it, in many cases taking place in urban areas, you know, in the cities and settlements of Gaza, you know, at the practical reality, you know, even if this isn't what, and this is, you know, I'm sure a lot of people disagree with this, but, you know, isn't what the Israelis are intending to do, it's practically, you know, a war on the population of Gaza, because there's no other way to fight that war, kind of war that they're trying to do, without, you know, that happens in and amongst civilian populations.
Would you have to know if this is their longest one? Because longer than even 1948? Because it's been going a while.
I'm not sure, but I would guess it probably is. You know, depending on your definition of when a war starts and finishes, you know, because, you know, there are formal operations and informal operations, and there's points where there's combat, but, you know, things are not as active. But, you know, I mean, what are we at? 9 months now?
Yes. So it's been going. I mean, I think.
Almost 10 months.
In 1948, I think it didn't bleed over to 1949.
I don't think so.
So I think this may well be their longest sustained conflict thus far.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I've said this before, but I really don't think that when they get to the end of this and decide they're done, that they will really have removed Hamas as a player. I mean, obviously they're going to have weakened them, but, you know, Hamas just they'll fade away when it's appropriate to them. And as soon as the Israelis step away from, you know, withdraw or whatever is their end game, they'll be right back.
Well, it would be good for the other side if like Israel won, because at least then it's over. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, I mean, Hamas is not going to win, but it's just that they're not winning. I don't know what it's rather odd. I mean, if they were to win, that'd be good.
Even if it would end things. I know what you mean, but I mean, I guess some folks would say that leave. You know, what does that mean? And does that mean that Israel stays in occupation of Gaza? Which.
Yeah, but you're ending a bit of carnage. You know? So even if you're very critical of Israel, I think it would be good if they.
But I know what you mean. I mean, you know, for whatever else it is, you know, this ongoing war and violence is probably, you know, the worst of all situations. But, you know, whether, you know, living under direct Israeli occupation, which might be the outcome, that's is seen to be better by people, I think a lot of people would say no, even if death tolls would be down. But
well, would the international community stand for that? Because I think they're they're losing a lot of the Christian Zionists now, actually, even. I mean, some of them are, I mean, only the most, actionary of Christian Zionists are going to remain Christian Zionists.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to become more critiqued internationally once this is over. Oh, and also Yemen. They got involved with the Yemen conflict, Israel.
And now there's a new thing with Hezbollah, because Hezbollah launched some rockets over the weekend and hit a school. So now, I don't think, at least as far as the news this morning, Israel hadn't really reacted yet. But they will, because, you know, from their perspective, they can't not react. Right, they're going to have to retaliate in some way because that's sort of their position. So who knows what happens with that, you know?
So I don't know. I mean, the question is, if it's a Donald Trump presidency, how is he going to? We don't even know what his reaction is going to be, because when some say, well, he's going to send more American support, maybe not. Kamala Harris is going to be more asking directly for a ceasefire or something like that. So,
yeah, well, hopefully, I mean, it'd be good to see if both campaigns clarify their positions there. I mean, we sort of see where Kamala Harris is leaning, but as you say, it's a difficult position. And I guess we'll see.
Well, she's making it clear enough, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. A couple of weeks ago, we reported or we carried a couple of features from our friends at KICK Radio, CICK in Smithers, about new treaties that have been initialed, the first new treaties in quite a while signed in BC. As you probably know, with the exception of Southern Vancouver Island and a few other treaties that have been signed over the years in, for instance, Tawash and Nisga territory. Most of BC is still undergoing a treaty process where ongoing negotiations to finally create formal treaty relationships between the First Nations in British Columbia and the governments. Provincial and federal governments. A few weeks ago, two new treaties were signed, which was a moment of celebration for those communities. But not all their neighbors are happy, and I think it illustrates perhaps the complexity of the treaty process, in that it's not just a matter of negotiations between individual nations and the federal government and the provincial government as well. But each of those treaties has impacts on their neighbors because, you know, territories are not neat and tidy. There's overlaps and things affect each other. So here's another report about the neighbors in that region are thinking. And thanks to our friends at CICK in Smithers for this report.
You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers, CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News, the community of Lac aux Lambs, along with Kitkatla, Gitgat Nation, and the Kitisu Hehe, announced their opposition to Canada and British Columbia initialing treaties with neighboring nations Kitsamkalem and the Kitsilis last week. Lac aux Lambs Rights and Title Chair Councillor Joey Wesley attended a meeting with provincial and federal Indigenous Relations Ministers, along with Kitkatla, Gitgat Nation, and the Kitisu Hehe, to express disappointment and concern over what Wesley called the failed Crown reconciliation efforts with each First Nation. In June, the federal and provincial governments initialed treaties with both Kitsilis and Kitsamkalem for land, resources, and continued funding for community and infrastructure projects. After the initialing of the treaties, Lac aux Lambs Mayor Gary Reese said now that the government has moved forward with the Kitsilis and Kitsamkalem treaties, it will be difficult to discuss reconciliation with Canada and BC as they ignore Lac aux Lambs' interests and infringe on their rights. Today, we'll speak with Lac aux Lambs Mayor Gary Reese about why they oppose these new treaties and how they intend to move forward with reconciliation as their trust in government erodes. Stay with us.
My name's Gary Reese, and I'm the mayor of Lac aux Lambs Band.
Great, Gary. Thanks so much for being with us here on CICK News again. I wanted to touch base with you today because Lac aux Lambs, as well as Gitkatla, Gitgat, and the Kitisu Hehe, issued a statement that they're in opposition to the treaty negotiations that have been going on with the Kitsamkalem and Kitsilis. Can you tell us a little bit more about why you and the other nations felt you needed to put out this statement and oppose the treaty negotiations?
Well, I'm aware of the initial of their treaty, both Kalem and Kitsilis. And, you know, we do support treaties that are outside of our territory and that they do not break traditional law or encroach on our rights and title. So we're totally against that when they came into our territory. And I'll go back a number of years when the Simpson Tribal Council was formed to negotiate treaties. And I sat in a lot of those meetings there when I was on council then. And they all agreed on the boundaries. There were maps that were put out and was done by their hereditary chiefs and elders of all the communities. And BC, federal government, and the Treaty Commission accepted those maps. And over time now that, you know, they've changed and are claiming into our territory. So we cannot agree with that.
Gary, what can you tell me about the Lac aux Lambs Reconciliation Framework Agreement? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, we've been in negotiations with that there, and on phase one, we are, for the lands part there, we've agreed to phase one lands that were going to be turned back over to us, and it's all agreed to by the province. It went to the cabinet, and everything was approved. That's all in place for that, and we're going to be going into phase two, and then there's an election coming up, so the provincial government said there was nothing that they're going to be able to do because of election that's going to be coming up. And yet they go on and initial those two treaties there when they tell us that. So we're not too happy with that.
Gary, tell me a little bit more about, you know, you've been working with the Government of Canada and BC on this reconciliation agreement. Obviously, there's other, you know, things going on as well, MPAs and all that business. We spoke the other week about this. How does this kind of create conflict or put into, you know, a little bit of jeopardy these issues, these other issues that you have to communicate with these governments for? Have they
responded to you after this statement regarding any of this?
Well, they haven't. I haven't seen any response, and we tried getting meetings with the government over that, and we had one meeting with them, and the allied tribes put out the information about our territory and that they don't agree with the First Nations claiming into our territory. They were well aware of that. You know, they haven't consulted with us yet with what is happening. And that's, you know, the law that they have to consult with us, and that hasn't happened.
Gary, I also know, you know, there's been some other, you know, conflict recently with the signs being cut down along the highway, other signs being set ablaze. You know, this seems to be just falling right into that issue that it seems that there are some disputed territories and boundaries now. However, as you mentioned, there are maps and data and information going back many years that outlined other areas and that everyone agreed upon. What do you think is kind of going on now? Why is this happening now? It seemed like this was dealt with before and it's bringing it back up.
Well, like, so I said that, you know, their boundaries are all drawn during the Simpson Tribal Council days, and, you know, we haven't changed ours. We have exactly the same boundaries that were put out and that was done by the hereditary chiefs and the elders of each community that when that happened. And over time now they changed and claiming into our territory. And you know, and I think it has a lot to do with development. And when the court case Haida Gwaii had there, where they had a consultant accommodate, some of these communities started claiming into our territory because it was all happening in our territory.
One other point you made in the statement was saying that there's been an acknowledgement that the ancestral territory and boundaries are non-linear and fluid. This is coming from one of the ministers. But you dispute that and say, no, that this is incorrect. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think they're well aware of what we, what our tribes have, our territory, and it's been put forward a number of times to them, and they just ignore that.
Gary, how would you like to see this move forward and be resolved?
Well, I think the government has to sit down with us and do the consultation with our communities and deal with it. And that has to happen.
Okay, Gary. Maurice, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for your time. We'll definitely stay in touch on this subject.
Okay, thank you.
That was Gary Reese, Mayor of Lac aux Lambs. Our colleague with the LJI in Terrace, Sabrina Spencer, was at the signing of the treaty on June 25th and spoke with Melissa Quacksister, a communications consultant who worked on the treaty.
The initialing of the Kitsum-Kalem Treaty on June 25th marks a significant milestone in the relationship between Kitsum-Kalem First Nations, the Government of Canada, and the Government of British Columbia. This treaty, influenced by principles from UNDRIP, focuses on preserving Kitsum-Kalem's culture and spiritual practices while advancing their autonomy. CFNR was on location for the initialing and later spoke with Melissa Quacksister, Communications and Community Engagement Consultant.
It's Melissa Quacksister. I'm a member of the Comox First Nation, and I work with Kitsum-Kalem as a Communications and Community Engagement Consultant.
Okay, so how will Kitsum-Kalem ensure that the treaty respects and supports the community's cultural traditions, language, and spiritual practices?
Good question. Kitsum-Kalem will support communities' cultural traditions, languages, and spiritual practices through their culture and heritage chapter, which is embedded with the governance chapter. It is also protected in the Kitsum-Kalem Constitution that they will always be able to practice, promote, and preserve their culture, languages, and spiritual practices. And that will happen with the guidance and direction of the Kitsum-Kalem people, hereditary chiefs, and spiritual leaders.
Can you outline Kitson Kalem's approach to ensuring fair and equitable representation of all community members in decision-making processes post-treaty?
Absolutely. Kitson Kalem will ensure fair and equitable representation of all community members in decision-making processes post-treaty through a forum that we've are calling the People's Assembly, the Kitson Kalem People's Assembly. So a minimum of once a year, there needs to be an assembly held where the Kitson Kalem government needs to present strategic plans, budgets, and any legislative pieces that need to be discussed on the floor. During that time, they will integrate and include feedback on any of these issues from the people. And the way the organization structure will work is, instead of having the council or executive or legislature at the top, it's actually Kitson Kalem members at the top, and they direct the government of Kitson Kalem. So it's not BC and Canada sort of dictating your leadership anymore. It's now the people who dictate. And if the leadership does not follow the guidance and direction of the people, then that will show in the following elections.
All right. So what opportunities does Kitson Kalem foresee for youth involvement and leadership development within the new governance structures established by the treaty?
Kitson Kalem foresees youth involvement and leadership and development within the new governance structures established by the treaty through a number of ways. We've discussed having elder representation on committees that inform or provide direction or information to the legislature or the administrative executive folks in the government structure. We have also at this time been, or in the past summer and this upcoming summer, looking at having some summer students take part in the work we do inside in communications and other Kitson Kalem work. Other than that, we have, our door is always open to youth. We do utilize social media such as Instagram and Facebook, mostly Instagram, to try and entice young people to take a look. It is very hard to connect with youth today, and we need to find their level of understanding. At the end of the day, all of this is for them.
What are the provisions in the treaty that support Kitson Kalem's aspirations for self-governance and autonomy over local affairs?
Provisions in the treaty that support Kitson Kalem's aspirations for self-government and autonomy, it's spelled out in the governance chapters, several governance chapters that speak to this, as well as there are, I would say, what it comes down to is Kitson Kalem, under the treaty, becomes a third order of government, along with BC and Canada. They are more than a municipality, have more powers and more authority. However, that doesn't give Kitson Kalem any authority over local governments, but an equal standing where they can work together for the betterment of everybody who lives in the Terrace area and the Kitson Kalem territory.
So how has Kitson Kalem engaged with local municipalities and regional governments to ensure alignment and cooperation on shared priorities post-treaty?
Kitson Kalem has engaged with local municipalities and regional governments over the last several years. We have had representatives from the regions or at the City of Terrace sitting at the treaty table over several years, so they have been sort of a part of it and a bit of a liaise with the rest of the local government there. And they have been in support, and over the past few years, as Kitson Kalem and the local governments have been getting to know each other, the relationship has been growing stronger. In addition, BC and Canada absolutely have a obligation and a duty to consult with their local governments as well, and Kitson Kalem has been participating as part of the team in those consultations with local government to ensure that they are aware of the process and where we're going, and answering any other questions.
And then the last question, what measures are in place within the treaty to enhance health care, education, social services for Kitsum Kalum members, particularly vulnerable populations?
Excellent question. So the measures that are in place within the treaty to enhance health care, education, and social services for Kitsum